Be sure to listen to the Church at Kaweah every Saturday and Sunday at 7 a.m. and 11 p.m. Pacific Time. The Church at Kaweah is a Lordship Church under the sole authority of Jesus Christ. You may contact the Church at Kaweah by calling 559-561-4860. That's 559-561-4860. And let them know how much you're being blessed. Thank you.
Record budget deficits, bankruptcies galore, and the U.S. dollar is at an all-time low. With today's gloomy economic outlook, safe investments are often hard to find. For over a decade, Melody Cederstrom at Discount Gold and Silver Trading Company has been helping people secure their future by investing in the precious metals. Melody has the honesty, integrity, and experience that is often lacking in the precious metals business. Let her put it to work for you. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188.
You're listening to FirstAmendmentRadio.com, Galaxy 13, Channel 16, Audio 7.70, and worldwide on the Internet at FirstAmendmentRadio.com.
Roll away the dawn, roll away the dawn, and let me see the land of the free. Has anything changed at all? Sweet liberty, sweet liberty is in our land. It's part of the plan, or is it a state of mind? Never forget.
You're listening to Jackie Patru and Sweet Liberty. Here's your host, Jackie Butcher.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for being with us tonight on Sweet Liberty. It's Wednesday today. It is the 22nd of June in the year 2005. June's almost over. Doesn't that seem unbelievable? Anyway, I'm glad you're with us tonight. We'll start here with our spiritual message. This is another card from My Course in Miracles quotes. This is from the text, page 776. I place the peace of God in your heart and in your hands to hold and share. The heart is pure to hold it, and the hands are strong to give it. We cannot lose. The peace of God. You know, in the world today, if we dwell constantly on what so many of us are becoming more and more and more clear about, it would be very difficult, I think, to have peace of mind. If we're constantly dwelling on it, I'm not saying to reject it or to pretend it isn't happening. We know it is. Maybe I'm just sharing this with you the way it is for me. And I find when I get a chance, for example, working outside, working in the flower gardens, and watching things grow, planting, and there's peace for me there. And I can lose myself in it. And I don't sit around thinking about this world and about the evil that is being committed in this world. If I did, I think I'd lose my mind. So it's nice to every now and then lighten up and find something to do that can take your mind away from it for a bit. Have some fun sometimes. Laugh, dance, whatever it is that you like to do. Because as children of God, that is our inheritance. But it is up to us, I think, to make a choice also, whether we're going to swim in it, wade in it, and wallow in it, or from time to time, are we going to change the subject? Well, we're not changing the subject tonight. We're going to pick up the economic interpretation of the Constitution of the United States by Charles A. Beard. I have the 1941 edition, which evidently is the in the second edition of 35. He had done a preface, and he also in this one said where he found new information that should have been in the first printing. And where I'm going to go is where we were last night. I have a sticky tab here to start. Here we are. I wanted to read, as we were going off the air last night, he was saying that for himself, he has never believed that all history can or must be, quote, explained in economic terms or any other terms. But he said, it can be explained, no doubt, to the satisfaction of certain mentalities at certain times, but such explanations are not universally accepted and approved. I confess to have hoped in my youth to find, quote, the causes of things. I think Charles Beard has found the causes of things. In his subtle way, the way I see it, he has said it many times in this book without coming out and talking about the money masters, those who are in such control of this world today because of their control of the money. And that's what it is all about. And that was what he was getting to with the book that he wrote, The Economic Interpretation of the Constitution, that those 54 men who were delegates of that constitutional convention, actually it wasn't supposed to be. They were supposed to be there just to amend the Articles of Confederation. And when they got there, it was all planned out, of course. They had the whole draft of the Constitution ready, and it became a runaway constitutional convention. And what they did, George Washington was presiding, and what they did is they created a committee of the whole, and they voted, and they declared the Articles of Confederation null and void, just like that. And then came the debate over the Constitution. And remember that they did this behind locked doors, folks, and locked windows. I was there, down there in Philly, at Independence Hall, and saw the room. We were inside the room where those 54 men gathered. Now, the room, I asked somebody if, in fact, it was the lady who was the guide, so to speak, that was telling us all about the history of the place. I asked her if she had an idea of the dimensions of the room, and some people laughed like that was a stupid question, but one man said he was an architect evidently, and it was about I think 20 by 40 feet. Well, I might be making this up. It was 40 feet for sure, but I don't think it was 40 feet square. In other words, we're looking at a small room, folks. 54 men inside this room, and they locked the windows shut. They started the debates on the Constitution. They began in May, and I don't know if any of you have ever been in Philly in May. It's like being in St. Louis, May, June, July, August, September, right into October. It had to be stifling hot in there, and they literally nailed the windows shut so nobody could hear them. So that's evidence right there that they were up to something that they knew shouldn't get out, wasn't it? But anyway, the author here goes on, and he says that it seemed to me, he said that he always hoped in his youth to find the causes of things, but he never thought that he had found them. And he said, yet it has seemed to me, and it does now, that in the great transformations in society, such as was brought about by the formation and adoption of the Constitution, listen to this, economic, and he put in quote, forces are primordial or fundamental and come nearer explaining events than any other forces. Where the configurations and pressures of economic interests are brought into an immediate relation to the event or series of events under consideration, and an economic interpretation is affected. And he said, yet, as I said in 1913, on page 18, listen to this, it may be that some larger world process is working through each series of historical events. I think the guy knew what was happening. Okay, now I'm going to skip over. I'm going to, he was talking about that in the first edition, in the 1913 edition, on page 93, he said, I state that Benjamin Franklin does not appear to have held any public paper. Evidence to the contrary is now available. In February 1788, Franklin wrote concerning the public indebtedness, and he said, quote, such certificates are low in value at present, listen, but we hope and believe they will mend when our new constitution of government is established. And the second fact pertains to the formulation of Hamilton's funding system based on the authority of the Constitution. It was long believed that this system was largely, if not entirely, the child of Hamilton's brain. But two letters found by Professor Wetterow among the Oliver Wolcott papers in the Connecticut Historical Society indicate an opposite view. Hamilton was a king's man, folks, and it probably was a Jew. I've got information that Fritz sent me, and I think I shared it with you once on Hamilton, because his mother was married to a Jew. Hamilton's first report on the public credit was laid before the House of Representatives on January 9th, 1790. In November of the preceding year, William Bingham, Philadelphia merchant, capitalist, and banker, wrote a long letter to Hamilton. William Bingham, by the way, owned, I have absolutely no idea how much land he owned in Pennsylvania, but up here where we live, Chuck and I did, we went to the county seat there in Wellsboro, and we were doing a search, you know, for the title search, and Bingham, the property where we live, where I live right now, was once owned by Bingham. And once he passed away, it got into, I think it was his son's hands, and then his son began parceling it up. Binghamton, New York would obviously be named after this Bingham guy, William Bingham. He just owned gobs of land. Anyway, he was a Philadelphia merchant, capitalist, and banker. He wrote a long letter to Hamilton in which he recommended, quote, virtually all of the essential measures subsequently proposed by the Secretary of the Treasury. That would have been Hamilton. During the same month of 1789, Stephen Higginson, mariner, merchant, and broker of Boston, also wrote a letter to Hamilton advocating measures similar to those laid before Congress by the Secretary of the Treasury and warning him against the perils of the opposition certain to be raised. Bingham, who was actively engaged in speculating in public securities, asked Hamilton to inform him, quote, how far any of my sentiments coincide with yours. Whether Hamilton replied is unknown at present, but Thomas Willing, Bingham's father-in-law, claimed to have been Hamilton's have seen Hamilton's, quote, whole price suggested for funding. And these new historical discoveries by Professor Wetterow throw light on the spirit of Hamilton's financial system and his connection with the mercantile and banking interests. And then over here, here's another page. I'm just skipping and just reading some highlights here to you folks. As you said, two other caveats should be entered. It has been lightly assumed by superficial critics, if not readers of the volume, that would have been the first one, that I have, quote, accused the members of the convention of working merely for their own pockets. The falsity of this charge can be seen by reference on page 73 of the original text, still standing, and there I say clearly, listen to this, the only point considered here, is, did the members of the convention represent distinct groups whose economic interests they understood and felt in concrete, definite form through their own personal experiences with identical property rights, or were they working merely under the guidance of abstract principles of political science? And then we're jumping over another page here. He says, nevertheless, listen now, whoever leaves economic pressures out of history or out of the discussion, you know, this keeps reminding me of what Alan says over and over and over. It's all about the money. The whole control of this whole world is because they control the money. And the only way they control the money is that they have found a way to create the faith of the people in the money. That's the ticket. But Charles Beard says that whoever leaves economic pressures out of history or out of the discussion of public questions is in mortal peril of substituting mythology for reality and confusing issues instead of clarifying them. And then he jumped down here, I'm jumping down. Listen, he says, it is for us, recipients of their heritage, to inquire constantly and persistently when theories of national power or states' rights are propounded. What interests are behind them and whose advantage will changes or the maintenance of the old forms accrue? And he said, by refusing to do this, we become victims of history, clay in the hands of its makers. And he said he printed this book in the hope that a few of this generation of historical scholars may be encouraged to turn away from barren political history to a study of the real economic forces which condition great movements in politics. Sounds like the guy knew what was happening, doesn't it, folks? And then he tells about that there's three schools of interpretation. And the first one, he refers to this Bancroft guy. Bancroft is one of them who constantly referred in his writings about the Constitution to a higher power which is operating in human affairs. Although he avoids citing specific events which may be attributed to it, well, there is a higher power, isn't there? But it's a higher power of this world. I'm going to jump over. Here. Oops, excuse me for all that noise. Trying to hold this book up and it keeps sliding down on me. We're on page 13 here. He says, he was talking about the law, see? He knows, see, you can get this book. I'd really like to read the whole doggone book to you, but I know I'm not going to do that. Anyway, he was talking about the law, and he said it may be said that constitutional law is a peculiar branch of the law, that it is not concerned primarily with property or with property relations, but with organs of government, the suffrage administration. The superficiality of this view becomes apparent at a second glance, inasmuch as the primary object of a government beyond the mere repression of physical violence is the making of the rules which determine the property relations of members of society. The dominant classes, whose rights are thus to be determined, must perforce obtain from the government such rules as are consonant with the larger interests necessary to the continuance of their economic processes, or They must themselves control the organs of government. They do, don't they, folks? He says, under any other system of government where political power is shared by any portion of the population, the methods and nature of this control become the problem of prime importance. In fact, the fundamental problem in constitutional law. The social structure by which one type of legislation is secured and another prevented, that is, the Constitution, is a secondary or derivative feature arising from the nature of the economic groups seeking positive action and negative restraint. He talks here about the unequal distributions of property. Okay, now we're over here on page 16. I've got this highlighted and underlined. I'm going to read about a page and a half to you. He says the requirements for an economic interpretation of the formation and adoption of the Constitution may be stated in a hypothetical proposition, which, although it cannot be verified absolutely from ascertainable data, will at once illustrate the problem and furnish a guide to research and generalization. It will be admitted without controversy that the Constitution was the creation of a certain number of men, and it was opposed by a certain number of men. Now, if it were possible to have an economic biography of all those connected with its framing and adoption, perhaps about 160,000 men altogether, the materials for scientific analysis and classification would be available. Such an economic biography would include a list of the real and personal property owned by all of these men and their families, lands and houses with encumbrances, money at interest, slaves, capital invested in shipping and manufacturing, and in state and continental securities. And that's what he does here in this book. He gives us a bio on these guys. He says, suppose it could be shown from the classification of the men who supported and opposed the Constitution that there was no line of property division at all. That is, that men owning substantially the same amounts of the same types of property were equally divided on the matter of adoption or rejection. It would then become apparent that the Constitution had no ascertainable relation to economic groups or classes, but was the product of some abstract causes remote from the chief business of life, gaining a livelihood. Suppose, on the other hand, that substantially all of the merchants, money lenders, security holders, manufacturers, shippers, capitalists, and financiers, and their professional associates are to be found on one side in support of the Constitution, and that substantially all or the major portion of the opposition came from the non-slaveholding farmers and the debtors. Would it not be pretty conclusively demonstrated that our fundamental law was not the product of an abstraction known as the whole people, but of a group of economic interests which must have expected beneficial results from its adoption? Obviously, all the facts here desired cannot be discovered, but the data presented in the following chapters bear out the latter hypotheses, and thus a reasonable presumption in favor of the theory is created. It may likewise be shown, to take an extreme case, that the farmers and debtors who opposed the Constitution were in fact benefited by the general improvement which resulted from its adoption. It may likewise be shown, to take an extreme case, that the English nation derived immense advantage from the Norman conquest and the orderly administrative processes which were introduced, as it undoubtedly did. Nevertheless, it does not follow that the vague thing known as the advancement of general welfare or some abstraction known as, quote, justice, was the immediate guiding purpose of the leaders in either of these historic changes. The point is that the direct, impelling motive in both cases was the economic advantages which the beneficiaries expected would accrue to themselves first from their action. Further than this, economic interpretation cannot go. It may be that some larger world process, listen to what he says here, it may be that some larger world process is working through each series of historical events, but ultimate causes lie beyond our horizon. And over here, as another thing, he was talking about the records. He says a complete analysis of the economic forces in the constitution-making process would require the geographic distribution of money on hand and loaned and the names of the holders, etc. It appears that much of the material from which evidence on these points may be obtained has disappeared, but an intensive study of the tax returns of the states, the records of the local assessors, wills probated, mortgages recorded, and suits in courts over loans and mortgages would no doubt produce an immense amount of illuminating information. He says, fortunately, the unpublished and unworked records of the Treasury Department at Washington throw great light on this fundamental problem. That's the geographic distribution and ownership of the public securities. Shortly after the federal government was established, the old debt was converted into new consolidated or funded debt, and holders of public securities, state and continental, brought their papers to their local loan office, one for each state, or to the Treasury to have them recorded and transferred into the stocks of the new government. The records of this huge transaction, which was the first really great achievement of nascent capitalism in the U.S., if they had been kept intact, would constitute perhaps the most wonderful single collection on economic history ever possessed by any country. Were they complete, they would form a veritable doomsday book of the politics during the first years of the new government. But listen to this, folks. But unfortunately, they are not complete. The records of Hamilton's administration at the Treasury itself seem to have largely disappeared. And the records of the loan offices in the several states are generally fragmentary, although in one or two instances, they are indeed monumental. None of the records preserved at the Treasury Department presents all of the evidence required for the scientific study of a single state. Nearly one-third of the operations were at the Treasury, and of these, only a meager fragrance seemed to have escaped the ravages of time. Listen to this. Under the government at Washington, follows the example of enlightened administration in Europe. Unless the government at Washington follows the example of enlightened administrations in Europe and is established as a hall of records, the precious volumes which have come down to us will be worked only with great difficulty if they do not disintegrate and disappear altogether. And he gives an example here. A few years ago, a Negro attendant attached to the Treasury sold a cartload or more of these records to a junk dealer. A junk dealer. Didn't they say that Rothschild was a rag picker or a junk picker or something like that, a junk dealer? Now, this makes me wonder, doesn't it, you, who this, quote, junk dealer was, that an attendant at the Treasury sold a cartload or more of these records? Don't let the people see them. Anyway, it says he was imprisoned for the offense, but this is a small consolation for scholars. The present writer was able to use some of the records only after a vacuum cleaner had been brought in to excavate the ruins. Okay. Now, there's one more place. This is just something maybe some of you are aware of. I wasn't. He's talking about the different people, the different classes of people in the country. And he's talking here groups of real property holders, the different groups of them. And listen to this, what he says. about he says, a one-source conflict was connected with the possession of the land itself. Much of the Western country, well, I better stop here. And then when I'm done with that, then we're going to get to the personalities, folks, because that's the last thing I have highlighted here to share with you. And then we'll get to the personalities, and you'll get some bios on some of these yahoos. We're going to be back right after this. Get your pen in your hand, if you will. This broadcast that you're listening to is brought to you by you. And if you're not bringing it to you, you're not going to be having it. Those of you who are listening and not participating, you got a free ride going here. But it can't last too much longer, folks. Not unless you all get on board. So you'll get my address now.
You're listening to FirstAmendmentRadio.com worldwide. Freedom is never free. We need your support today at FirstAmendmentRadio.com.
Now listen to me. The Bible says, render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's. I want you to know that a corporation is Caesar.
Government takeover of the church. This DVD is the most powerful tool we have for waking up those asleep in the pews. The scripture calls for his people to come out of her. The corporate church is the apostate church, the whore that rides the beast. Get this DVD for a donation of $25 from FirstAmendmentRadio.com. Make copies and give them away to your corporate church friends and loved ones. The truth will make them free. They will watch the DVD, Government Takeover of the Church. Order online today at FirstAmendmentRadio.com or call 559-781-3773. Who will tell them if not you?
Roll away the dawn.
You have been listening to Jackie Petrou's Sweet Liberty program on the First Amendment Radio Network. This broadcast is also archived and audio streamed on the internet at FirstAmendmentRadio.com. Sweet Liberty is a fully listener-sponsored program. Your donations to support these broadcasts are a necessity. Send your check or blank money order to Jackie Petrou, P.O. Box 190, Millerton, P.A. 16936. Again, send your check or blank money order to Jackie Petrou, P.O. Box 190, Millerton, P.A. 16936. Be sure to visit the SweetLiberty.org website. Thank you for your continued support. And stay tuned to FirstAmendmentRadio.com.
Okay, here's just one more thing I want you to hear, and then we're going to go to the personalities. I think we're going to start with George Washington and Robert Morse, though. There's a whole bunch of them, well, 54 of them, and almost every single one of them were lawyers and land brokers, and many of them were Jews. It's amazing. But they weren't all. Anyway, he's talking here about the different groups. And he says the first of these groups, of the property holders, small farmers, constituted a remarkably homogeneous class. The inland section was founded and recruited by mechanics, the poorer whites, and European, particularly Scotch-Irish immigrants. It had peculiar social and political views arising from the crude nature of its environment, but its active political doctrines were derived from an antagonism to the seaboard groups. One source of conflict was connected with the possession of the land itself. Much of the Western country had been taken up by speculators, and the settlers were either squatters or purchasers from large holders. This is illustrated by the situation in Virginia, where, as Ambler points out, and this is a quote from a book evidently, he said, liberality in granting her unoccupied lands did not prove to be a good policy. This is using Virginia as an example. true, large number of settlers were early attracted to the state, where they made permanent homes, but much of the land fell into the hands of speculators. Companies were formed in Europe and America to deal in Virginia lands, which were bought up in large tracts at the trifling cost of 2 cents per acre. The wholesale engrossment soon consumed practically all the most desirable lands and forced the home seeker to purchase from speculators or to settle as a squatter. As the settler sought to escape from the speculator by moving westward the frontier line, a speculation advanced. So, they just never quit, do they? Now we're going to go back here to the economic interests. But what I want to do, I'll just share a few of the first ones here with you. I mean, because he's got these things alphabetized. The first one is named Abraham Baldwin. He was a rich lawyer. Abraham Baldwin, probably a Jew, a private fortune. Abraham Baldwin's private fortune there is little known. His father was evidently well-to-do, for he enjoyed the advantage of a classical education at Yale before he established himself in the practice of law at Savannah, Georgia. He soon rose to eminence in his profession and was reckoned among the ablest and shrewdest lawyers of his adopted commonwealth. These are the guys that were there at the Constitutional Convention. So, and I'm just going to give you a few brief here. Richard Bassett of Delaware was born in 1745, adopted son of Mr. Lawson, a lawyer, who married a Miss Inzer. The Inzer family was Herman's heir to Bohemia Manor. Mr. Bassett was educated and trained for the profession of law by Mr. Lawson, whose heir he became. By this inheritance, he came into possession of 6,000 acres of Bohemia Manor, which, we are informed, embraced the fairest and best portion of the manor. Through his inheritance and accumulations in the practice of law, he became one of the wealthy men of the state. A biographer notes that his fortune was large and he entertained lavishly at his three homes in Willington, Dover, and at Bohemia Manor. He was in intimate terms with the leading financial men of the community, very active in securing a charter in Delaware for the Bank of North America. When it was attacked by the Pennsylvania legislature, and was warmly thanked for his success by President Willing in a letter. Then we go to Gunning Bedford of Delaware, was the son of a substantial landowner. Bedford of that name appears on the tax list of Newcastle County for the year 1776. He was a lawyer, but the extent of his practice is not known. He was of high standing in the community and was elected governor of his state a few years after the convention met. He took an interest in the financial affairs of the state, and under his administration as governor, the Bank of Delaware was organized. Now we're going down to John Blair. He gives the details of their holdings as far as their securities and etc. connected with the government, but I'm not going into all these folks. Here's another rich lawyer. They're all rich lawyers so far. John Blair of Virginia was born in that state about 1731, received a collegiate education, prepared for the law, and in a very few years rose to the head of his profession. In Pierce, in his notes on the men of the convention, says, Mr. Blair is one of the most respectable men in Virginia, both on account of his family as well as fortune. He's one of the judges of the Supreme Court of Virginia and acknowledged to have a very extensive knowledge of the law. Okay. Blair took advantage of the excellent opportunity afforded by the formation of the new Constitution to profit by the rise of securities. Then we have William Blount, North Carolina, a rich land speculator, the son of Jacob Blount, who died in 1789, leaving a large estate. Very early after the establishment of the new government, Blount was connected with land speculations on a large scale. In 1790, he was appointed by Washington to the post of governor of the territory south of the Ohio. Blount became a senator from Tennessee. Was implicated in a plot. In July 1797, President Adams sent a message to Congress asserting that there was a conspiracy in the Southwest to wrest New Orleans and the Floridas from the King of Spain and transfer them to the English crown, and adding that Blount, who was then a senator from Tennessee, was implicated in the plot. The U.S. immediately took action and, after inquiry, expelled him by a vote of 25-1 on the charge of high misdemeanor. These guys were at the Constitutional Convention. Our founding fathers, folks. David Beerley of New Jersey was a rich lawyer. Chief Justice of New Jersey, then U.S. District Court Judge, owned 1,600 acres of land near Newton, New Jersey, a 100-acre plantation on the Delaware, besides several thousand acres of land near Lawrenceville. He received the honors of Princeton at the age of 18. Okay, then we have Jacob Broom of Delaware. His father, he was a rich moneylender and a real estate mogul. His father, James Broom, Jacob's father, referred to as James Broom Gentleman. Broom was a man of diversified financial resources, interested in cotton mills and other enterprises, was one of the original stockholders of the Insurance Company of North America, organized at Philadelphia in 1792. He was also one of the organizers and original stockholders of the Delaware Bank, established under Bedford's administration. And then we have Pierce Butler of South Carolina, a nobleman, stockholder, and director of the First U.S. Bank. They were all insiders, folks. George Clymer, he's from Pennsylvania, the son of a well-to-do merchant and shipbuilder of Philadelphia. He was a brother-in-law of Mr. Meredith, the first treasurer of the Union, also a man of large fortune. Mr. Clymer's intimate associations were therefore mercantile and financial, and his large fortune and quick understanding of the needs of trade and commerce made him one of the first men of his city in the Revolution and gave him a wide influence during the critical period, the formation of the Constitution and the establishment of the new government, which he served as a member of Congress and later in several other capacities. Let's go over to George Washington, okay? Then we're going to... time goes too fast sometimes. Washington of Virginia. I wanted to do, what's his name, too? Robert Morse. He was that buddy of Chaim Solomon and George Washington. Let me see about Robert. I haven't even read Robert Morse myself because I haven't gotten that far with this. Okay. Of all the members of the convention, Robert Morse of Pennsylvania had the most widely diversified economic interests. Born of the humble parents in Liverpool in 1734, came to America at an early age. The death of his father about 1750 left him a small estate of a few thousand dollars, which stood him in good stead in his relationship with the Willings, whose counting house he had entered to learn mercantile arts, in which he showed an early proficiency. Let me see here. In the course of his long career, he owned and directed ships trading with the East and West Indies, engaged in iron and several other branches of manufacturing, bought and sold thousands of acres of land in all parts of the country, particularly in the West and South, and speculated in lots in Washington as soon as he learned of the establishment of the capital there. He was instrumental in organizing the Bank of North America in Philadelphia with Thomas Willing, his partner, as first president, and Thomas Fitzsimmons, an associate, in his land and speculative enterprises as one of the directors, and was, in short, a merchant prince, a captain of industry, a land speculator, a financier, and a broker all combined. Had he been less ambitious, he would have died worth millions instead of in poverty and debt after having served a term in a debtor's cell. This goes on, and it brings Washington into it. Maybe truly said that Morris was an effective representative of the speculative land operators, the holders of securities, dealers in public paper, and the mercantile groups seeking protection for manufacturers. In short, every movable property interest in the country. It was fortunate for the new government to have in its support a man whose economic power and personal acquaintanceship extended from New Hampshire to Georgia. It seems fair to say that no man contributed more to the establishment of our Constitution and the stability of our national institutions than Robert Morris, the quote, patriot financier. Washington, therefore, showed his acumen when, as first president of the U.S., he selected Morris for the office of Secretary of the Treasury. But the latter, on account of the pressing nature of his private business, was unable to accept the post. Indeed, he wisely concluded he could be more serviceable to the new government in his capacity as senator from Pennsylvania. And in this position, he lent his powerful support to the funding system, the new bank, and the establishment of a protective tariff. Morris and Hamilton together worked out a tariff bill, says Oberholzer. But for the influence of the senator from Pennsylvania, the measure, important because it would provide the national government with ample revenues, because it had protective features of utility in the development of the country industries, could not have passed Congress in the form which would have commended it to the Secretary of the Treasury. Okay, we're going to go over to Washington now. We're going to go to George Washington. I hope you can hear me. Here. Washington of Virginia was probably the richest man in the United States in his time, and his financial ability was not surpassed among his countrymen. Remember, George Washington was presiding as the chairman or whatever of the Constitutional Convention, folks. Washington possessed, in addition to his great estate on the Potomac, a large amount of fluid capital, which he judiciously invested in western lands, from which he could reasonably expect a large appreciation with the establishment of stable government and the advance of the frontier. Perhaps the best way to illustrate his economic interests is to give the data from the schedule of his property attached to his will drawn up in 1799. He possessed in Virginia, counting the enormous holdings on the Ohio and the Great Kanawha, more than 35,000 acres, valued at $200,000. In Maryland, 1,119 acres. In Pennsylvania, 234 acres. In New York, about 1,000 acres at $6,000. In the Northwest Territory, 3,051 acres at $15,000. In Kentucky, 5,000 acres at $10,000. Property in Washington at $19,000. In Alexandria at $4,000. In Winchester at $400. At Bath, $800. He held $6,246 worth of U.S. securities. And of this holding, he said, these are the sums which are actually funded. And though no more in the aggregate than $7,566 stand me in at least 10,000 pounds Virginia money, being the amount of bonded and other debts due me and discharged during the war when money had depreciated in that rate. and was so settled by the public authority. He held $10,600 worth of shares in the Potomac Company, presented to him by the state of Virginia, which he left to establish a national university, $500 worth of James River Company shares, $6,800 worth of stock in the Bank of Columbia, $1,000 worth of stock in the Bank of Alexandria. His own slaves were to be emancipated on the death of his wife. His livestock, he estimated, at $15,600, making a grand total at a conservative estimate of over $500,000. Washington was also a considerable money lender and suffered from the paper money operation of the Virginia legislature. He had bonds and mortgages to nigh 10,000 pounds, paid off in depreciated paper currency worth at times as little as 2/6 in the pound. And when he attended the federal convention, he was in arrears for 2 years' taxes through having been unable to sell the products of his farms. If anyone in the country had a great, a just reason for being disgusted with the imbecilities of the Confederation, it was Washington. He had given the best years of his life to the revolutionary cause and had refused all remuneration for his great services. He was paid his personal expenses to the amount of $64,000 in paper that steadily depreciated. Mr. Otto, writing to Vergennes on February 10th, says of Washington's losses, "I have before me a letter of this honored man in which he complains of being obliged to sell at a rate of 20-for-1 the certificates which Congress sent to him in payment for the arranges due him." You know, I'd like to read more about all of his land holdings and when he got them, because I read someplace that Washington was where they go out there with the little thing, surveyor for the East Indian Company. And I know that Chuck and I took a trip to Florida in 96 to visit his dad and stepmom and brothers, and on the way back we went through Virginia, Natural Bridge or something like that. It's a national park. Anyway, there was a sign there that said that the land was owned by George Washington. That was in Virginia. There's a lot more in this book, folks, but you know what? Why don't you call? If there's anything that you would like to talk about, or any of you that you might have something to add. I am tired, and I don't feel like doing this anymore. And we've got about 7 minutes left, so why don't you give me a hand here and give me a call at 570-537-3025. This is the last night of our broadcast week, and usually I have things that I sometimes wish we had another day or two, and I'm glad tonight. Hi, thanks for calling in. Hi.
Oh, hi. Yeah, Storm.
Hi, Storm.
I'll make this quick, though.
Oh, yeah, well, you got about...
No, I'll make it quick so you can get another call. We on the air?
Yeah, we're on the air, honey.
All right. What I just wanted to say is a couple of things. Oh, that was very good what you did tonight. I was sitting here listening. A few things. You may already know this since you're kind of way ahead of me. There was bombings in Iraq, and we lost so many. There were American casualties. They don't know how many.
When was this, honey?
What?
When?
Oh, just a little louder. Today. It was announced.
Oh, okay.
Yesterday.
Okay.
But two things I was going to mention is, you know, you talked about this stuff earlier with this control and stuff. There's an article here in Newsday. I'm not reading it, but there's an article here in Newsday entitled "In Rejection of the European Union, Voices of Pride." That European Union is totally falling apart. I mean, it's
kind of rambling. Storm, you're kind of rambling here.
So what I was going to say is that I don't believe the European Union is going to stand.
Well, you know what? I hope you're right. You know, it's...
Yeah, because you know why... I'll make this very quick and I'll hang up. The European Union, the Deutsche Bank is not a German-owned bank. It's a bank controlled by Rothschild. Rothschild, the British queen, you know, and her family, and it's paper money. And the purpose of it, really, I believe, was that if they can get everybody on the European dollar in Europe, they could create another 1929 situation.
They could do that anytime they wanted to with any currency they decide on.
Yeah, but they can't do it in multiple currencies all at once.
Oh, I got you. I see what you're saying. They want the single currency.
No, you have to have single currency to do that.
Yeah.
See, if you have the Deutschmark being 69 cents and the lira is 49 and the British pound is like 167, and, you know, it's too many different things. They want to consolidate. And so, you know, and the other thing I was going to say is this. You mentioned something you got from Vanguard Books or something with Who Rules America or something like that. I got that thing.
Yeah, it's on our website, honey.
Under all on the website.
It's under Shadow Government.
Oh, I see. So you just took a scanner.
At sweetliberty.org.
Right.
There's a search engine in there.
What I was going to say is this, that... I don't think the control that you're talking about, even though it is there, these people aren't the smartest thing in the world. They're not the smartest businessmen in the world. I'll let you go. But, you know, even the stuff you're talking about with the Jewish control or not, I'm a businessman. I mean, you're a former businesswoman yourself. And a lot of the stuff that they do, I mean, if you studied it, tactics, you know, they can't be beaten. I mean, even financially. I mean, but I'll go. I'll let you go.
Okay.
You take my call. Bye.
Thanks, Storm. You too, honey. Bye-bye. We've got a couple minutes left if somebody would like to call in. It is 570-537-3025. I wish I could believe that Storm was right. And we do know always that with our Creator, all things are possible. And boy, I'll tell you what, if we didn't keep that in mind, folks, might as well go get a backhoe and dig a hole and just crawl in it and pull the dirt in over us. Believe in miracles, for with God all things are possible. And I know they're beatable because we've beat them, haven't we? I know in 93 they intended to have the Constitutional Convention, and they didn't have it. And then in 95, they were going to duplicate exactly what went on back in 1787. They were going to hold their Conference of States, because that's what it was called when they got together in 1787. They called it the Conference of States. And they were going to hold it in historic Philadelphia, and they got squashed. So we know that they are not infallible. And Storm, thank you for that reminder that we need that. Folks, we're out of our week here. I want to remind you, please, that the broadcast is brought to you by you. And for those of you who aren't, you are being cordially invited to become part of this. If you'd like to see it stay on the air, it's $140 an hour just for the short wave. And boy, I'll tell you, that builds up in a hurry. We'll see you back Monday. Have a lovely 4 days. And do some gardening, folks. Do something that makes you feel good. Good night. God bless you.